Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have our phones, some of the lines open, and you can call in during this hour if you have questions about the Bible you'd like to ask on the air, questions about the Christian life, Christian theology, Christian apologetics, whatever. Or if you're not a Christian and you have, you want to call about Christian things, you want to bring challenges to the Christian faith, I'd be glad to talk to you too. Anyone who disagrees with the host is welcome on the program. And of course, if you just have a question, that's what our main format is. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Kevin from, looks like, Mequon, Wisconsin. I don't know if I'm saying the city right. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Yes, it's Mequon. You're pretty close.
Okay, never heard of it.
Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate your ministry. About a month ago, you said something pretty profound to me because I've just been probably like many people, really struggling with the racial justice and the social justice issues. And you had said, and it really brought it home to me because I've struggled with so many, because there's so many issues or topics that I'm like, gosh, I don't agree with that at all type of thing. But you had said that, yeah, you know, as Christians, we should stand for every sort of justice and against every sort of injustice. And that made me think a little more like, you know, when we have topics or sides of something, whether it's, you know, a Democrat platform or a Republican platform or a Blue Lives Matter or a Black Lives Matter, you know, when we stand on a platform like that, we, you know, we can be standing on the wrong side when certain issues and topics come up, because Black Lives Matter has not always been right and the police have not always acted appropriately in every case. But if we stand in justice and take everything individually, we'll be better off. And so my question is our church, and I've been going there for 24 years, and so I'm getting very disheartened with some of the things that are going on, because they are taking up some of these topics as social justice topics and, you know, having people get together and Zoom videos, and it doesn't take up a lot of time. It does a little bit from time to time during our services, but they mostly stick to the gospel and their, you know, what they're teaching and things like that. But it's not like it's not integrated from time to time, which again is troublesome because it's completely one side and it's the popular side that's in the media right now.
Okay.
So I guess I'm, you know, they sent out a video after this long Zoom meeting of like 40 people logged in and were talking about certain things, and it was guided. But yet we also had breakout sessions that people were taught would talk about. So, but again, every video we were shown, everything was just simply one-sided. And I researched some of these things on my own, and I will listen. I'm better off listening to debates like, you know,
okay.
Candace Owens.
Well, let me just jump in here. Let me jump in here,
yeah.
Kevin, and just say that you've been speaking for 2.5 minutes. I'm not sure what your question is going to be. Did you
sure.
have a question?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, you know, I'm struggling with how far, you know, you go down a road with a church before, do you simply base it off of how if you're getting fed or not, or, because I still feel like I'm getting fed, but yet all these things are permeating church, and I'm trying
sure.
to
gotcha.
Push back as
I
best
hear you.
I can type of thing, and I'm like, let's hear both sides of this topic instead of just one.
Okay, well, let me just say this, there's many reasons why a person might leave a church. But when you've been in a church for 24 years, you probably better make sure you have some pretty good ones, simply because it would be, unless your church life has been very deficient for 24 years, you probably have a lot of important relationships in that church. So it's hard to go to church and be very involved without forming relationships. And after, you know, 2.5 decades, there, I would imagine that most of your important Christian relationships are there. Now, I could be wrong, because some people just attend church on Sunday mornings, and most of their important relationships are with people who go elsewhere to church or from other places, you know, so I don't know. I would say when it comes to leaving a church, you really need to decide how many and how important the relationships you are that you have are in that church, and whether something that's happening in the church is enough to part company with those people. Of course, you can part company with the church assembly and still be friends with those people, still see them and so forth, and that might be what you would end up doing. But if they stay, they're going to be imbibing a lot of the ideas that you're finding difficult with the church too. I think the best thing to do is do what you can to try to communicate with the leaders of the church, at least until you find out that it does no good. If you find out that it does no good, then of course finding a different church is probably going to be a good idea. But a lot of evangelical pastors are just not very, I don't want to say it, but they're just not very smart about Christianity. They believe that the thing they need to do is take the side that sounds like a good side, and especially one that the younger people are more likely to hold to, because if you take a different side, well, you're going to alienate people, and very few pastors want to alienate people from their church. And the word social justice sounds so good. I mean, justice is a Christian word. Justice is a biblical word. Justice is a priority for Christians. Living justly and standing for the oppressed and so forth. These are all very Christian concepts. But when I say some pastors don't think very clearly about these things, is they don't investigate or think rationally before they decide what they're going to support. The social justice movement is not a movement for justice. Justice, according to God, is that every man receives what he deserves. That's how God's judgment is going to be. Everyone will receive the things done in his body. Everyone will be judged by his deeds. Nobody's going to be judged by somebody else's deeds or what race he was in or what his ancestors did. In God's justice, even a son will not be punished for his father's misdeeds, much less will a generation be punished for deeds of their ancestors several generations back, which is what social justice demands. See, social justice ignores personal merit, which is the only thing that real justice considers. Real justice considers individual merit, and it doesn't. And it's colorblind. If a white man commits a crime, he is judged a criminal. If a black man commits a crime, he's judged a criminal. If a Hispanic man commits a crime, he's judged as a criminal. On the other hand, if a black or Hispanic or white man is innocent, then he's not punished. In other words, people in a just society and under God's principles of justice, people are rewarded or punished for what they themselves do, not for the group they belong in. And social justice is not justice. It's rather punishing one group on behalf of some other group. Generally speaking, the group that's being punished has been regarded to be an advantaged group. And the group that's being vindicated, allegedly, is a group that's been a disadvantaged group. But you can't increase the sum quotient of justice by being unjust to half the population. You cannot increase justice by increasing injustice. The only way you can increase justice is treat everyone according to their desert, what they've done. And that's not what social justice advocates. Social justice advocates that white people should be punished in either financially or otherwise. Their monuments should be torn down. Their buildings and businesses should be destroyed. Why? Well, because of the color of their skin. It's the opposite of justice. Justice is colorblind. In the law of Moses, which was where perfect justice was enunciated for Israel, the judges were told, do not skew judgment in favor of the rich and do not skew judgment in favor of the poor. You should be perfectly just in all your dealings. So because someone's poor, now that's disadvantage. You don't skew justice in their favor if they don't deserve the favor, and if the people that you're having to punish to skew justice on their favor are innocent. Real justice, and Christians should be passionate about this, is that we stand for innocent people being protected and guilty people being able to receive what their actions deserve. And that's what justice is. Social justice isn't justice. It's it's really Marxist organizations always give themselves names that few people would ever want to disagree with. Who would ever disagree with the expression Black Lives Matter, for example? Every decent person knows that Black Lives Matter. No one has ever doubted it. But now you have to almost side with the organization by that name, or else you sound like you don't think that Black Lives Matter. It's ridiculous. The organization by that name has nothing to do with Black Lives Matter. It has to do with advancing a Marxist agenda and destroying the traditional nuclear family and doing other things like that, abolishing police. I mean, this has nothing to do with blacks. This has something to do with a political Marxist agenda. And I'm not speaking politically. I'm just saying this is what it is. You can see it. Go to their website. See what they stand for. And pastors who want to be hip and contemporary, they're kind of jumping on the social justice train and hoping, I suppose, that they will, maybe their church won't be burned down or the windows won't be broken if they speak loudly enough for Black Lives Matter. But really, churches are supposed to speak loudly for Christ and for righteousness and for justice and for what God stands for. And God does not stand for punishing one race instead of another. In fact, God wouldn't even allow favoritism to be shown to a Jew. Now, they were his chosen race, his chosen people. He would not allow in the courts favoritism to be shown to a Jew over a Samaritan or over someone else. And hey, the Jews had a history of slavery, just like black people in this country do. The Jews had spent hundreds of years in slavery. But the Jews later, when they came out of slavery, weren't in slavery. And there was no favoritism supposed to be given to them in the courts over the Gentiles, even though the Gentiles of a previous generation had persecuted the Jews of a previous generation. You don't suffer for what was done in previous generations. You suffer or you're rewarded for what you do. You as an individual, doesn't matter what skin color you have, what you do, you should get what you deserve. That's it. And that's what justice is. So I'm totally opposed to pastors not thinking things through, which is apparently what most pastors who are, certainly I think all the pastors right. who are supporting social justice are in that category. They're just not thinking through. If you can't talk some sense into them, then you may have to find another church, but it's a shame. It's one of those things, you know, I often have people calling me and saying, you know, I've been going to this church for 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. and now they're moving in such and such a direction, which is some kind of heretical direction. And they say, you know, I don't want to leave the church. Well, sadly, the church left you. You didn't leave it. And now, you know, if you start going somewhere else, it's because the church didn't stay where they were supposed to be, where they were when you first joined them. Now, I think churches can progress. I think churches can change, but they better change in a positive direction, not a negative one. They ought to change to be more like Christ, right. not more like the world. As they get more like the world, right. I think those who want to be like Christ are going to probably have to move on to other churches. I appreciate your call. Robert from Carlton, Texas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing? Good talking to you. I'm going to make it quick, now hang up and listen to your response. It's about Joseph in the Bible, a son of Jacob. You know, in chapter 35, it speaks about, you know, when Jacob was moving and he ended up in Bethel. And from Bethel, he moved on, and then his wife, Rachel, she gave birth, but she died.
Right.
Okay. And then, of course, then they moved on, and then going to chapter 37, you know, she had Joseph with one of her sons, which says that Joseph was a dreamer. 37, verse 9, speaking of one of his dreams, when he said that I had this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And then, you know, moving forward, when Joseph went into Egypt, became second under Pharaoh, and when his brothers came, they bowed down. He said he remembered the dream. My question is, his official dream, he mentions, I believe it was the sun, the moon, and 11 stars. But
right.
mm-hmm. Where does Rachel fit in that? Because she had already passed. So I'll hang up and can explain why is the moon Rachel, or, you know.
I hear you.
Refers to Rachel or somebody else because it seems like she's already passed away. So I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Right, she was. Okay, thank you for your call, Robert. For those who don't understand the problem, when Joseph had his dream when he was 17 years old, His mother had died 17 years earlier when he was born. At birth, she was she died in birth. So she'd been dead for 17 years, and he had a dream in which he said the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to him. Now his father, understanding the meaning of that symbolism, said, "What shall your father, shall your mother and I and your 11 brothers bow down to you?" Now, obviously, his mother was gone, was dead. And so there's no problem, no possibility, I should say, that she would bow down to him, not in this world anyway. And they didn't really have much of an idea about the next life. And certainly the dream pertained to this life. It pertained not to the next life, but to the fact that when Joseph was made grand vizier in Egypt, that his brothers did come and bow down to him. I don't remember if his father bowed down to him or not. He may have, but but his mother certainly didn't. But I think that instead of being literal about that, I think what Jacob was recognizing is simply that Joseph's dream was implying that Joseph would rule the family. And, although Joseph didn't have his natural mother living, he must have been mothered by somebody. There were three other women in the family who were wives of Jacob, and they were taking care of babies. So he probably had a surrogate mother or a foster mother or something like that. In any case, he was not without a female in his life. And I think the thing is that whoever was serving as his surrogate mother at that point, whoever had raised him, he was indebted to them, just like he was to his own father. And I think Jacob was suggesting, what, your parents, the people who are above you, people that you're indebted to, you're just a child, but they're going to bow down to you. And I don't think that Jacob necessarily had Rachel in mind. If he was speaking of Rachel, that'd be simply maybe his way of saying, this is never going to happen because the moon would represent your mama. She's dead. That's not going to happen. But I don't think he was thinking that way. I'm just thinking he was recognizing the dream, the imagery of the 11 stars and the sun and the moon represented Joseph's whole family. And to take the moon as literally referring to Rachel would seemingly be impossible. Though, of course, when you read the story, you wonder about that. I mean, I have many times, but I think we have to assume that he's just taking that whole imagery collectively as referring to his family, not necessarily specifically to Rachel as the moon in the picture. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Rich from Everett, Washington. Rich, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I had a question. I've called in the past, and I usually have a specific verse or passage, but it's more of a subject or topical kind of question now. Matter of fact, even more specifically about a book. I have a friend who's pretty trusted, recommended a book to me that I'd never heard of from an author I'd never heard of, and I was just wondering if perhaps you had, and then maybe ask you a question more broadly on the subject. The book is called The Unseen Realm by Michael Heiser.
Heiser, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever read that book? Are you familiar with it at all?
I have. Yes, I've read it. I mean, everybody's reading. It's kind of the thing. It's kind of the thing to read now. You know, I mean, it's like, at one time it was, The Purpose-Driven Life. Everyone had to read that book or something. But it seems like not everybody's reading Michael Heiser, but I think a lot of people, especially young people who are theologically oriented. I mean, it's kind of a heady book. It's a book for people who are thinking. He's a Bible scholar. He's a Hebrew scholar and a very competent one.
Mm-hmm.
And encouraging in one sense that so many Christians are taking an interest in rather sophisticated theological conceptions. Not that those things save us or make us more spiritual, but it just shows that people have an interest in understanding the Bible more, which has not always been the case. And so, but I'm not entirely in agreement with Michael Heiser. I'm not aware of anything he teaches that I'd find dangerous. Like I say, I listened to the book on audiobook, and I also have it in hardcopy. Uh-huh. I've read portions of it earlier before I listened to the whole book. So I've been through the book, and I've also heard him give some lectures a few times on YouTube and so forth. But he makes some assumptions I don't. But they are assumptions that cannot be ruled out. So, in other words, he's not saying things that are clearly wrong. He's saying things based on certain verses that are capable of being interpreted more than one way. And the way he interprets some of those verses isn't necessarily the same way I do. But they aren't the kind of verses upon which anything very important hangs. I mean, I don't really know of any practical issue in my Christian life that would change in any way if I adopted all of Michael Heiser's views, but I don't hold his views. So, so in other words, my position is, well, first of all, there's a lot of things in the Bible that are of lesser importance, and because they're of lesser importance, God didn't really give a lot of clear teaching on them. And what we do have, maybe in terms of hints of on those things, are verses that are sufficiently ambiguous that they could be taken more than one way, because it's not that important for us to know. Frankly, I personally think that's God's reasoning. You know, if it was everything that's important for us to know is pretty clear, but some things are not as important for us to know. And there are allusions perhaps to such things in certain verses in the Old Testament, the Psalms, Psalm 82, of course, and Deuteronomy. He uses those verses quite a bit. I don't see any. I'll just say I never understood those verses the way he does, although I was always familiar with them and have taught through them. So, in other words, his interpretation is not a necessary one, but it's not it's not a heretical one. Okay, so as far as reading Heiser goes, I would say I would never discourage it. I think he's got a lot of insights in the Old Testament. He's a good evangelical scholar of the Old Testament, but he happens to have sort of a, I don't know, I almost would say kind of a hobby horse about what he calls the divine council that God consults with, you know, and what their role is and all of that. I don't see anything about that information which, if he is correct, would make any difference to me. But he happens to base it on interpreting certain passages a certain way, which I, in most cases, would interpret differently. So that's
I was going to ask you about his, I've been through his website and listened to some of his lectures, and I found it very interesting. You know, something that maybe I wasn't aware of, and I wanted to ask your opinion on this, maybe it's just broader in his book. You talked about the term Elohim, which I always thought was a specific term to God. And he says, well, Elohim is really a term of a class of beings, spiritual beings, of which the Almighty is the Most High Elohim, and that other spiritual beings, demons, angels, and such, are also considered Elohim in the Old Testament. Is that accurate?
That is his opinion. It's not impossible for that. It's not impossible for that to be the case, because the word Elohim is a plural word, and any time in the Old Testament where you find the word gods plural, it's the word Elohim. Eloah is God, or El is a short form of God in Hebrew, but Elohim with the im at the end makes it a plural. So Elohim means gods, and it is commonly used in the Old Testament to refer to the gods of the pagans, the gods. It is also a word that is used for God himself. Even though it's a plural word, sometimes it appears in sentences where the grammatical structure has a verb requiring a singular subject, but Elohim is the subject, so that it's like the sentence is treating this plural word as if it's a singular. And when you find that in the Bible, it's translated God, as in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created, that's Elohim. It shouldn't be translated gods, because the word created in the Hebrew is in a form that requires a singular subject, and Elohim is the subject. So it's kind of mysterious. Elohim can mean gods, plural, or it can mean God if it's used in a certain grammatical way. Now, to say that angels are gods, or that, you know, the divine council are a group of gods or whatever, is going beyond anything the Bible specifically says, but it's agreeable with Heiser's interpretation of Psalm 82:6. I said you are gods, or God sits in the council of the gods, that Psalm says. Now, of the Elohim. The thing is, Elohim is sometimes used, I believe, to speak of the judges and the rulers of Israel. There's at least three places in Exodus, in my opinion, where the word Elohim is referring to judges. In fact, where the traditional translation translates it as judges. And so the Elohim sometimes refers to the judges. And the rebuke of the Elohim in Psalm 82, I consider to be a rebuke to the judges of Israel for their injustices, not referring to actual divine beings. But when I listened to Heiser, I wasn't sure at first. Is he saying there's a lot of real gods? But no, he says they're created beings too. He's basically just using this divine counsel thing. He's just basically, when he calls them gods or Elohim, he's just talking about the same thing we would call angels. So, I mean, whether the Bible uses it that way is another story, but that's how he's understanding it.
Or in pagan cultures, demons that are worshipped.
Well, right. Right. I mean, all the pagan gods are called gods. And both Deuteronomy and 1 Corinthians 10:20 tell us that the gods that worshipped by the heathen are demons. So whether the gods refer to the demons behind the idols or simply to the idols themselves would be a matter of controversy, in my opinion. I need to take a break here, but I hope that that's dealt with the subject for you.
It is great. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, Rich. God bless you. We're not done. We have another half hour coming up, and we're not going away. But I am going to take a break here and let you know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. We buy radio time. That's why you can listen to us every day, because we're paying a lot of money to radio stations. And most programs do that, but they might charge, or they might have underwriters, or they might have sponsors. We don't do that. We just say, listen, if listeners support it, we stay on. If they don't, we don't. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com.
As you know, The Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to The Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com, where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Our lines are full, but if you want to take down this number, you can call in later, and there might be a line open for you. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Amy, calling from Corvallis, Oregon. Hi, Amy. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question sort of about divorce, sort of about people walking away. I have a friend who's moved out of the house from her husband, and I think her main problem at this point is being shut down. She hasn't rejected God, but she doesn't feel like she's hearing from him, doesn't really have that feeling of being connected to God, and I'm looking for verses that I can use to encourage her. I know that regardless of what happens with her marriage, that she needs to be turning to God and not giving up on him and not walking away from him for her own sake, for her kids' sake. And I have like two other relationships in my life where people are also in the middle of their marriages falling apart, and it gets to me.
Amazing?
I am an adult child of divorce, as is my husband. So I want to make sure I'm pointing people to God and not just advising them based on my own personal experience.
Amen. Amen. That's good. Good desire. Well, let me ask you, what is her complaint against her husband?
It's not sexual infidelity, but it is, I guess, a situation in which she didn't feel she could continue to live forever.
Well, nobody's going to live forever with their spouse.
Well, sure, I guess till death.
Well, death isn't that far off. I mean, what's the
That's
problem?
That's what I said.
What is the problem here? I mean, we're all going to die within a few decades.
There's been a substance abuse. Sorry, I don't mean to speak over you. There's been a substance abuse problem on his part, as well as sounds like verbal abuse.
Well, that's not very nice. Someone needs to talk to him.
Yes, we have been.
Okay, so they've been to counsel about this?
They've been to counsel, apparently, through our church. We didn't realize until we found out 3 weeks ago that they felt let down by the church, that no one persisted with them, and so she felt her only choice was to move out.
Well, you asked if there's anything you could help her with. The problem here is we have way too many people who call themselves Christians who want to be Christians and obey God as long as they feel like it, as long as it's easy, as long as they don't have to sacrifice much, as long as they don't have to obey hard commands. In other words, there's a very serious question about whether they are Christians, because becoming a Christian means that you surrender all that. You give up all that you have. For you lay your life down. You take up your cross. I mean, if you don't do that, you haven't become a Christian yet. And when you have done that, you're not worried about hard decisions or sacrifices. You've given up your rights to Christ, and you're all you care about is pleasing Him. Now, she's not in that place, you said, and I'm not saying that all Christians feel that equally strongly at all times, because obviously we have temptations and we have high spots and low spots emotionally. But nobody who has ever known Christ and who has a brain cell functioning in their head wants to leave Christ. I mean, when people want to leave Christ, their brains are malfunctioning. I mean, I can't imagine how anyone who's ever really known God would ever say, you know, I don't mind being on His bad side. You know, I don't mind if I thumb my nose at Him. He's, you know, what's so important about Him that I need to obey Him? People like that, like I said, either don't have a brain that's turned on, or they never knew God in the first place. Now, some Christians don't have their brains turned on all the time, and they need to. But she needs to realize that there's nothing more important, including her happiness and her peace of mind, or her peace in a marriage. There's nothing more important than being in the center of God's will. And when I hear in these days of people leaving their husbands or leaving Christ, because frankly, you swear to God when you get married that you're going to stay. That's something you promise to God and to your spouse and to all the witnesses who were in the room when you promised it. That's a promise you made in the presence of God and swore in the name of God, in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. That's what Christian marriages include. So that means that a person says, okay, I swore to God I was going to stay all my life, but, you know, I can, who cares? You know, who cares about keeping those promises? I got to say, I just have no respect for someone who will take a step that direction. I understand it's hard. Believe me, I know, because I've been in a hard marriage myself. I'm in a wonderful marriage now, but I've been in a torturous marriage in the past. And I know how hard it is to stay. And my wife was sleeping with other men even, and I wouldn't leave because I made promises. Now, I think I could have left if she was sleeping with other men, and she was, but I still felt that I said for better or for worse. And it's not a matter of what can I get out of, but how can I best honor God and my integrity and keep the promises I made? That's where I'm at. I'm
100% with you. My husband and I joke with our house church leaders that we should hand everyone who comes to our house church a toy pistol and say, this is your way out of your marriage in this house church.
That's about right. It should be the only way out. Now, as far as that goes, I'm sure since you're counseling here, you've told her what the scripture says about things. I mean, you asked me what scriptures you could use, but you probably have used the ones I would suggest, you know.
Well, what I'm looking for mostly is not the ones about marriage, but things that I can give her about staying true to God regardless of your feelings. Don't rely on your feelings to tell you whether or not God is true or whether or not God is talking to you or whether or not He still cares about your life. Because I think she's let herself become so shut down by the pain of her marriage that she can't feel anything anymore. And I want to encourage her to pursue God anyway and not rely on her feelings.
Well, I, as far as specific verses, I would recommend that you have her listen to my series called Making Sense Out of Suffering, because that's what she's going through in that marriage, is suffering. And the series talks about, and has, you know, scores of verses, maybe hundreds of verses in the series, about suffering and about staying faithful in suffering and so forth. I can't just pick out one or two that would be better than all the rest, but I would suggest that series. Maybe even that you listen to it for her sake and, you know, be able to communicate it with her. The main thing that she needs to know now is that to go with your feelings at a time like this instead of with your character is to court disaster. Disaster for you, between yourself and God. Disaster for your children, if you have children, if you're thinking about giving up your marriage. It's nothing good. There's nothing good about leaving a marriage that you promised to stay in, especially when there's no grounds for divorce. Now, if he was being physically violent and she was in danger, my counsel would be get out of the house, stay, you know, somewhere safe with friends or family, and pray for him to repent. Pray that, you know, by your getting out, he'll begin to take things seriously and that he'll, you know, go to rehab or he'll go to counseling or he'll repent or something so that the marriage can be restored. I'm not against a woman putting a safe distance between herself and her abusive husband if he's truly hurting her. But I am saying that, you know, we give up on marriage too quickly. Americans give up, even Christians give up on marriage much too quickly without any warrant. And, you know, when you give up on your marriage, you're really making your life difficult, because if you don't have grounds for giving up on your marriage and you get married again, you're committing adultery. And you're putting yourself in huge peril spiritually. I just think people need to think more seriously about what it means to be committed to God and to put Him first in your life. You see, if God is first in your life, that means that you don't sleep with your neighbor even when you feel like doing it. It means that you don't chew out your wife even when you feel like it. It means that you don't, ram into somebody on the freeway who cut into you, even if you feel like it. You don't go by your feelings. You go by your character. You go by what you know is right. And if you don't do that, you'll never make it as a Christian. I don't think people will make it to the end, will endure to the end, if they haven't learned to go with truth, go with integrity, go with what's right, go with what pleases God, and not even give a thought to how it makes you feel. And it's awfully hard for some people to not think about how they feel. You know, I one of my most listened to lectures is called Refuse to be Offended. And frankly, that's one she could listen to too. But in it, I teach that you can refuse to be offended. And you should, you know, because offense brings a wedge in relationships. And God wants those relationships not to have wedges in them. He wants them to be reconciled. So you need not be offended. Well, many people say that's the best lecture they've ever heard and changed their life, and they have to listen to it over and over again. But a few people have said they don't like the lecture, and frankly, it's always been women. I'm not saying there aren't any men who find it difficult, but the only ones I hear from are women, and they say, you know, what are we supposed to be, machines? Are we supposed to be like robots that don't have any emotions? Well, no, you're not supposed to be like someone who has no emotions. God has emotions. We're all supposed to have emotions. But we're not supposed to let our emotions make decisions for us. Our character, our convictions have to make the decisions. And sometimes if our emotions make it hard to make those decisions, well, that's where our faithfulness to God is simply under test. But emotions change. Your convictions shouldn't change very often unless you get corrected about something you're wrong about. But emotions change all the time. So to make life decisions based on how you're feeling, it's just the biggest folly I can imagine. Anyway, I think that she should listen to the Making Sense Out of Suffering lectures at the website. They're, of course, everything's free there. And also under the topical articles, I don't know if you're aware, there's an article I wrote on divorce and remarriage, which she may be a candidate for reading that. I think everybody
okay.
is.
I'll look those all up on your website. And thank you for being honest about your own marriage. I think a lot of Christians work to hide those details because they want to honor the spouse. But I appreciate your and your wife's bravery to share that.
Yes, and the spouse that was is now an atheist, and she would not be ashamed about me saying that she had affairs, because she doesn't think it's wrong. But anyway.
I see.
I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Bye now. Okay, John from Murrieta, California. Been waiting a long time. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Early in my Christian life, I worked with a United Pentecostal bunch of guys, and they used to use your verse here from Matthew 7:13-14, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there's few who find it. I maintain they would misuse it. So based on this verse, how do you reconcile Revelation 7:9, where he says, after this I looked, and there was before me a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and the Lamb? How do you reconcile few that find it with the great multitude before the throne?
Sure. Well, first of all, Jesus never predicted that there would be few that would be saved. He told his disciples that there were few finding the right way. As he was speaking, he uses the present tense. He's given counsel to his disciples about which way to go. And he's saying, you know, many people are on the wrong way. And, you know, the path to destruction is wide and many people are traveling that way. And the path to life is narrow, and very few people are traveling that way. It's more of a social commentary on the religious world of his time, that, you know, not very many people were going the right way. Not many were following him compared to the number that were going the wrong way. He was not making any predictions about the end of the world, how many people would ever be there. Certainly, even if only a minority of people worldwide became Christians, that would still be a huge number after 2,000 years of harvesting in that minority. It's going to be cumulatively a very large number of people. But I don't even know it's always going to be the minority. You know, there's nothing in the Bible that says it'll always be a minority of people who believe. It may be someday that a majority will. We don't know. But as far as Jesus' remark, he did not predict that few people would be saved. He said that few people were finding that gate and that path.
Would that be like the remnant? And always, he always had a remnant. They were always the few, and they were the ones who found it. And the majority of the Jewish nation was on the broad path, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, got it. Understand.
All right, brother. Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Okay, bye now. All right, Eric from Port Orchard, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Greg. Or Steve.
Hi there.
Hey, you're amazing. I have a quick question. Revelation 20, do you think that we are at the point where Satan has been released for a short time? And I will take the answer on the radio.
All right. Thank you. You know, Revelation 20 is the chapter about the millennium, and I'm an amillennialist. Probably a great number of our listeners are premillennial, and some are postmillennial. So we would have different ways of looking at the chapter. So I think Eric knows my position, and therefore his question makes sense in terms of my position. A premillennialist wouldn't be able to make sense of the question at all. Could we be in that little season? Because a premillennialist doesn't believe that the millennium has begun at all, and it won't until Jesus comes back. So we could not, of course, under that view, be at the end of the millennium when Satan is loosed again for a little while. But on the premillennial view, or excuse me, the amillennial view, which is the one held most in church history by most Christians, that view holds that the millennium is symbolic for the age of the church. And at the end of that, there is a little season where Satan is loose and things get unprecedentedly bad for the church. Satan goes out and deceives the whole nations for a little while. And they come as a great army and they surround the beloved city, which is the image in Revelation for the church. And so the church becomes surrounded. He says it's from the whole world, from across the whole world. And their number is like the sand of the seashore. So here's a huge, huge, huge number of people globally persecuting the church. And I personally believe that that speaks of a time at the very end of the age, which will be interrupted by the second coming of Christ. In Revelation 20 and verse 9, fire from heaven comes down and destroys the wicked who are coming against the beloved city. Well, fire from heaven, Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 1:8 that Jesus, when he comes, will come in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. So amillennialists believe that Revelation 20 and verse 9 is the second coming of Christ, which of course is still anticipated, but it comes not just at the end of the 1,000 years, but at the end of 1,000 years plus this little while at the end where Satan is loose and where he's making unprecedented trouble for the church. And so your question is, since I hold that view, do I believe we're in that little while? Do I believe Satan has been loosed? Now, I have to say it's not an impossibility as far as I'm concerned. I've never been one in at least the last 4 decades of my ministry to try to predict the proximity of the end. I don't think we have any unambiguous markers that we can go by that would say, well, we're certainly going to see, you know, Jesus in this generation or the next one, or even in the next century. I don't assume that. On the other hand, things that are happening today could well fit that description. I do believe Jesus could come whenever he wants to, and therefore, even though I don't have certainty that he'll come in my generation or my children's or grandchildren's generation, I will say that he's going to come sometime, and it could be whenever he wants. So it could be today. But I think that if I think the loosing of Satan at the end is going to have to be really, really a bad time for the church. And although we are seeing bad times for the church, of course, the church around the world has had lots of persecution throughout all of history, but I think it's talking in that passage about a global situation. There's never been a time, to my knowledge, that the entire church around the globe was suffering intense persecution where there was no part of the world to which Christians could flee. It seems like almost always in severe persecutions, there's been some other country or something that Christians could flee to, and often they did. But if it's global, that would seem to be unprecedented. We're not there yet, and it may not develop to that. I mean, I'm watching. I don't plan to know. I don't plan to really know when this is the case, because things could get very, very bad in our lifetime without it being that same very, very bad time that is spoke of in Revelation. There's been a lot of very, very bad times in the world history. So to tell you the truth, your question, I think my answer is it could be. It could be, but I would not commit to it. It could be that what's going on right now will reverse itself. There will be revival. There will be, a change in the direction of society. Who knows? But there's no promises that that will happen. And if the present trajectory continues, that's going on in just this year is pretty much, although it's been building up for decades, but especially in this year, such radical changes have happened. If that doesn't turn around in a while, I'll probably have some suspicions that we could be living at that time. But my suspicions would be nothing for you to go on. And it wouldn't really even matter if we know, because frankly, even if it's not that time, it could get as bad for us here as it will be for anyone at that time. You know, when some people say, well, I don't think God would let his church go through tribulation, I often think about church history. There's people throughout history, and even now in many countries, who are going through as bad as can be things. I mean, the torture, the horrendous abuse, the killing of them wholesale. I mean, how could an antichrist in a future tribulation do worse things? The only thing that would be worse is that if he was doing it, it'd be, according to the dispensational view, it'd be worldwide. Now, I believe there will be worldwide persecution, but, you know, the worst that happens to anyone at that time cannot possibly be very much worse than what's happened to many Christians currently or throughout history. So and that could happen to us. That could happen here in this country, even if it's not the end of the world. Remember, when the Roman Empire fell to the Romans, that seemed like the end of the world. But that was 1,500 years ago. If the American nation falls, that'll seem to us like the end of the world. But it doesn't mean it is. I mean, we are very provincial people, and we tend to judge the whole of what's going on in the world by what's happening in our little backyard. But it's not a foolish question to be asking, and it's something that may prove to be true. I guess that's the most I can say in terms of being positive, which is really being negative. All right, let's talk to Scott from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. The Roman Catholic Church says that Luke chapter 15, verse 7 says that where the heavens rejoice whenever one sinner repents. And they try to say that that's Jesus saying that all the saints who have died, that's how they possibly know what is going on here on earth, because somehow God lets them know, because they use that verse to say that's how it happens.
Well,
I was wondering if verse 10 blows it out of the water.
Of chapter 15 of Luke?
Yes.
Yeah, likewise I say there will be joy in the presence of the angels of God over the sinner who repents. I believe that Matthew or Mark has the same statement saying, all the angels rejoice. There's no mention specifically of departed saints rejoicing. But, I mean, so what if it did? I mean, the Roman Catholics would like to suggest that the departed saints are in a position to be monitoring us, listening to us, hearing our prayers if we would pray to them, and so forth. And the Bible nowhere gives the impression that that is the case. But if a sinner repents, there could be rejoicing among God and his angels. And if there's saints up there, you know, hearing about it, they could rejoice too. It doesn't mean that they're paying close enough attention to the world to know what kinds of things we may be praying and so forth. I don't think it gives any support to the Catholic, specifically Catholic notions about that. I appreciate your call. Vinny from Charlton, Connecticut. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I've been listening to your lectures on faith and healing, and I was just wondering what your thoughts might be on the meal that heals.
What is the meal that heals?
Oh, you haven't heard about it? I know there's books on Amazon. We got this fellow in my church. He's been raving on about Kenneth Hagin stuff and all that, and I've been listening to it, trying to debunk it in my own mind. I mean, I'm totally convinced that that it's off the wall.
Right. So you have heard my lectures on the Word of Faith?
Yeah, except for the second half of the lecture. I haven't heard that yet. The introduction was phenomenal, and the first part was phenomenal. And I thought for sure you would have heard of the meal that heals.
Well, what is the meal that heals? What is the meal that heals?
Well, it's communion. The way I get it.
Who calls it that? Do the Word of Faith people call it that? I don't remember them calling it that back when I used to read their material.
Yes. I noticed I couldn't find out exactly what the theology is, but there's a number of books on Amazon about the meal that heals. And the way this fellow was setting it up, as though he was about to enter in another false doctrine.
Yeah.
And he was setting up the meal that heals. That's all.
Well,
the pastor has mentioned it a couple times.
I was taught when I was young, not by Word of Faith teachers, but by charismatic teachers nonetheless, that when Jesus said, when it says in Isaiah, by his stripes we're healed, that when we take the bread of communion, and Jesus said, my body is broken for you, that he's talking about the stripes that he received at the whipping post, and that they were for our healing. And so some people have said, and I don't agree with this, I don't think there's any biblical basis for it at all, but some have said, therefore, you know, eating the bread of the communion is perhaps a commemoration of not only the death of Jesus, but his whipping and of his, stripes healing us. And therefore, perhaps that as you take it in faith, that you can expect to receive healing at that moment. Now, I've heard that teaching years ago. I never heard it called the meal that heals. But when I hear someone talk about the meal that heals, it strikes me as very possibly talking about that concept. If it is,
That sounds exactly like what he was talking about.
Yeah,
Okay.
Let me just say.
Do you agree with it?
No, I do not agree with that. I think that's superstitious.
I didn't think so either.
I don't think the Bible teaches that there's any supernatural thing that accompanies the taking of communion. Now, I realize Catholics think there is, and many other, some Protestant groups do. They believe that when you take communion, it imparts grace to you and so forth. But the only thing I read in the Bible is that faith imparts grace. Grace comes through faith. I don't read anywhere in the Bible that taking communion produces any faith or any grace or, frankly, any results of any kind. Jesus just said, do this in remembrance of me. And so when I do it in remembrance of him. But that doesn't mean there's anything supernatural going on. Anyway, those are my thoughts on it. I believe that's strictly a charismatic Word of Faith kind of a teaching. Though, I haven't read any books by that name. That's not the term they used when I was reading their material years ago. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to see how you might help us stay on the air. That's thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.